Well, we're in 1 Samuel 29. We just got started in this last week when the time came out on us. The first two verses talk about the Philistines gathering their armies at Aphek. And I guess this is as good a time as any to see if I can get this to come up. Okay. Aphek, of course, this is from Aphek here. That's up around the area that is north of the central breadbasket of Israel up into this plain area. This is the same area where Jabin, king of Canaan, and Sisera, his famous captain, brought their chariots. And you'll see the Philistines are going to have similar weapons when they fight against Israel. This is an all-out attempt on the part of the Philistines to wipe out Israel, maybe once and for all, but at least the first of many, if necessary. And so they've gathered all their armies at Aphek, and the Israelites encamped by a fountain, which is in Jezreel. This is giving us a flashback to chapter 28. And then you'll notice in verse 2, the lords of the Philistines passed in review by hundreds and by thousands, and David and his men passed in review at the rear with Achish. So Achish is one of the five Philistine lords who has been kind of shielding David, and David has been deceiving him as he's been going around making raids in various places, taking spoil, and then telling him that he's been fighting against his own people, the folks of Judah. His dilemma now is, if he goes on with Achish and stays in this lineup where he is, he's back at the rear guard with Achish, and he goes on to the battle, he's going to be expected by these Philistines to take up arms against his own people, the Israelites. If he chooses at that point to say, I can't do this, and starts to fight the Philistines, they're vastly outnumbered. David would practically be surrounded, you would think, being there with the Philistines on his side of the line. And so I don't know that David will be able to survive that. So he's in a real dilemma. Verse 3 tells us, the princes of the Philistines said, what are these Hebrews doing here? And Achish said to the princes of the Philistines, is this not David, the servant of Saul, king of Israel, who has been with me these days or these years? And to this day I have found no fault in him since he defected to me. So several things in that verse. It's a loaded verse. The Philistine lords, the four besides Achish, can't believe their eyes when they look and they see David and his men. They can't believe their eyes. Achish can't believe his ears. What do you mean? This man's been with me, as we'll see in a moment, 16 months. I have learned to trust this man. We've developed a bond. We're close. He's been engaged in all these raids against Judah. All this time he's been with me. He's battle proven. He is trustworthy. What do you mean? I can't believe my ears. And they said, we can't believe our eyes. The expression they use here is what? These Hebrews. You notice are and doing here are all in italics. And I don't know if they saw it and they thought abbreviated expression was the best way to say it. Hebrews? No, that would be a way to emphatically state something without any further ado. Or maybe their speech just left them. What? These Hebrews? And that's all they would have to say. And that's literally all they do say. Would David, if he goes, would he really fight against the Lord's anointed, against Saul? Do you think he would? After not taking up arms against him all this time, you think now he would say, well, if I'm with the Philistines, I can take up arms against Saul? Do you think he would? I don't think so. So I don't think that's going to work for him. Do you think he's going to take up arms against Jonathan, his best friend in this world, whom he has given his word to try to protect and keep his progeny in line? Certainly not. On the other hand, would he turn against the Philistines after the battle started? Not unless he has a kamikaze wish and he wants just to be killed, and he wouldn't be in this Philistine territory if he just wanted to die. Plus, that wouldn't let him be king. So he's in a real dilemma here. And do you know who comes to his rescue? In the providence of God, who comes to his rescue? It's these Philistine lords. What? These Hebrews? Is David's door out of this dilemma? Now, you've seen a previous case of something like this in chapter 25. When Abigail comes to David and she says, I am so sorry, David. My husband, Nabal, is named correctly. He's a fool. and I didn't see your men when they came. And if I had been there, I would have fed them. And even now, I've brought stuff for you and your men. You well deserve it. The servants have told me how you took care of our people, and on and on and on. And so if you have any fault, let it be with me, not with my silly, foolish husband. Remember David's response? Why, if it hadn't been for you coming here, I wouldn't have spared any male in this entire place that you own. I would have killed every person here. But God's providence used a woman at the right time, at the right place, with the right words to stop David from something he would have hated the rest of his life. I believe the same thing's being done here. And is it possible that in God's providence, He could use Philistine lords, enemies of God, to serve a useful purpose for one of His people? Is that possible? Was it ever done any other time? Go with me to Acts 2. Now in Acts 2, you'll notice when Peter starts talking, he's setting things out like they are. Verse 22, they know who Jesus is. The wonders and miracles and signs prove who He is. Then verse 23, Him being delivered by the, what? Well, by the treachery of a Judas. Is that right? Well, that had its part. But could God use a scoundrel like Judas to put Jesus in the place where He could become our Savior? Well, certainly so. Him being delivered by the evil Jews like Caiaphas and Annas and all the others who teamed up against Him. Is that true? Oh, yes. And is it just as true that Pilate had his part to play in his lack of courage? Well, yes. But notice who's it attributed to in verse 22. A man attested by God to you by miracles, wonders, and signs which God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves also know. Him being delivered by the determined counsel and foreknowledge of God. Could God use a Judas? Could He use wicked Jews? Oh, yes. You have taken by lawless hands, have crucified and put to death. Was it God's will? Yes. Did He use lawless hands to do it? Yes. And you'll notice also in chapter 4 when He's speaking of the same circumstance, He calls upon their facts. They call upon the facts in the case. They're praying here. Verse 27 of Acts 4. For truly against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate with the Gentiles and the people of Israel were gathered together to do what they wanted with Jesus. Is that true? Yes, but that's not what this says. What does this say? To do whatever your hand and your purpose determined before to be done. Does that mean that the Jews got out their Old Testaments and they were reading and they said, you know, the Messiah is supposed to die for our sins. I guess we better go betray Him so that God can reward us for helping Him fulfill His plan. No. They don't care who they have to fight against. Even God they'll fight against as long as they can get rid of this pain in their neck. But you notice it's attributed to God. The whole thing was. The same thing, I believe here, without any doubt, is true of these Philistine lords. Philistines see what David could not see. David's been their greatest enemy. Why would they want their greatest enemy to come into their midst? How could they ever trust him? Now, what is a modern application of that principle? An enemy in the midst. A wolf in the flock. I think it's pretty obvious. In Romans 16, here's a case where Paul is warning about some people who may come. In verse 17 of Romans 16. Romans 16:17. I urge you, brethren, note those who cause divisions and offenses contrary to the doctrine which you learned, and avoid them. For those who are such do not serve our Lord Jesus Christ, but their own belly, and by smooth words and flattering speech deceive the hearts of the simple. So what does he say? He says, these people, verse 17, you note these. They're to be marked so everybody can see what they are, what they will do, and the result will be disastrous if you don't. The same way in Galatians 1 with the Judaizers who had come in. Galatians 5, these men are deceitful people who don't care for the truth anymore. These are people who in Ephesians 5, you have unfruitful works of darkness. What fellowship do you have with the unfruitful works of darkness? 2 John 9 through 11. So today, many times, men will come in to a congregation, and they'll have as their goal to win over, first of all, the young people. They'll get with them, and they'll have a lot of community activities and a lot of fun, what they will call fellowship with them, and they'll gradually give a little more and a little more until finally they win them over to their side. And if any point along the way someone decides to say, I don't think that's right, they'll not invite that person again, or else they'll say, well, I'm not affirming this. I'm just asking a question. They have several ways they can deal with this, and I've known them to do both of those and others. And as a result of that, next thing you know, the church is indoctrinated and is in deep, deep trouble. And so these people, the Philistines, know that you don't bring someone from the other side to fight for you. Which of you, you're a Cardinal fan? Some of you? Cardinal fan? Would you invite someone who's off for the day, maybe a New York Yankee, to come in and play for your team? Would you? Especially if you get somebody who's in the same league. Maybe you get somebody who's a Dodger. They're in the National League, aren't they? Would he come and let him play for you for one day? And especially if you're vying both to see who can win first place, you think he's going to do what you want him to do, or is he going to jeopardize it so that they'll get the first place? Isn't that simple? We see it all through life. And that's what he's saying here. They have no hard evidence that David has really changed. And until they see the hard evidence, they're not going to have David in their midst. They suspect treachery. And you know what? They're right. David is not one of them. He's going to go and be the king of Israel and fight them. 2 Samuel will show battle after battle after battle where David defeats the Philistines by the power of God. They can't afford to take a chance like this. So David and his men, in God's providence, have another thing going for them. At this point, not after they've been in the battle for 3 days, but at this point, David desperately needs to return to Ziklag. Why does David need to return to Ziklag? Because while he's been gone marching with these Philistines toward the goal of killing as many Jews as they can, the Amalekites have raided the city of Ziklag and taken David's wives, his spoils, all his men's wives, children, and spoils. They've burned the city and they're gone with them. And if they haven't killed them, they'll sell them as slaves and spend the spoils that they've taken. It's imperative David leaves immediately. You know who gets David to leave immediately so that he won't give them time to go and sell those slaves or kill some of them or get rid of all the spoils? You know why he's able to get back so soon? Because these Philistine lords said, we don't want this man with us. Send him away. And they didn't know they were saving the families of David and his men. The providence of God is a remarkable, remarkable thing. And we see it evidenced in this passage. Another question we would raise is, how could David ever become king if he has fought for the Philistines against Israel? Is that the kind of king you want in Israel? I don't think so. So if he had pressure and if he had opposition, which 2 Samuel is going to show he has plenty of opposition, well, it would have been 100 times more and he wouldn't have been able to become king. Achish still thinks David's been faithful and trustworthy these years. 27 verse 7, this one full year and 4 months, 16 months in all, 27 verse 7. And you notice he says in verse 3 that he has, since he defected to me. I found no fault in him since he defected to me. Why is it he found no fault in David during this time? He didn't know what David was doing. Why didn't he know what David was doing? You know, dead people don't talk. And David told him the opposite of what he was doing, where he was going, who he's fighting. So yeah, he thinks everything's well. The word deserted here means fail. David has fallen out of favor with Israel. He failed. He has nowhere to go. I've taken him in. He's apparently like a father to David. So it means to desert. This is David's falling away from Israel. And he's firmly convinced it's happened. Now in verse 4, the princes of the Philistines were angry with him. I think they can't believe he's let him stay here this long in their midst. And I think they believe he's foolish. That's a mild word, I suspect, in their vocabulary. Even to think that David can go with them. So they're angry with him. So verse 4 goes on to say, so the princes of the Philistines said to him, make this fellow return, that he may go back to the place which you have appointed for him, that would be Ziklag, and do not let him go down with us to battle, lest in the battle he become our adversary. For with what could he reconcile himself to his master if not with the heads of these men? They see very clearly what David would be capable of doing. Now, I suggest to you, as you look at this verse in verse 29, in chapter 29, in verse 4, this is David's way out. Those four words, make this fellow return. We don't want him to be anywhere around us. Make this fellow return. Put him back in the place where he needs to be, because if he doesn't go home, we're all going to be leaving this world quicker than we had intended to. Now, go back to the place. That'd be Ziklag. The exact location of Ziklag is unknown. I've seen maps where they have as many as three different places with question marks over them. Nobody knows quite for sure where it is. But it's in the southern region, east of the Philistine territory, and down in the south below Hebron, apparently. So, the Philistine lords illustrate a principle that whenever a person is engaged in something and a temptation comes to him, what does God not allow to happen when we're tempted? Say it again? He won't let it be beyond our ability to resist. 1 Corinthians 10:13. And that's partly what you might see illustrated here. And the Philistines know about division among the people of God. They know that David and Saul are divided. That's a sorry thing for the world to know. It's Saul's fault that it occurred. It never should have occurred. But in verse 5, is this not David of whom they sang? This is their finale. This is going to end the discussion. Is this not that same David, they're saying, of whom they sang to one another in dances, saying, Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s. This is their greatest charge against David, his public demonstration when he let everybody know where he stood, and that is, look what he's done to Philistia in the past. Killing Goliath was embarrassing. That was so embarrassing for the Philistines. They ran like rabbits. But having the women of Israel sing that song, Saul killed his thousands, but David his 10,000s, that was the worst. That was devastating. So in verse 6, Achish called David and said to him, surely as the Lord lives, you have been upright, and you're going out and you're coming in with me, and the army is good in my sight. For to this day, I have not found evil in you since the day of your coming to me. Nevertheless, the Lord's do not favor you. Do you notice anything strange, peculiar about Achish's oath? He calls on the true God. He doesn't say, as Dagon lives. He doesn't say, as the Ashtaroth live. No, he's calling on the name of the true God. Now, is he doing that in deference to David, saying, I'll be courteous to you and say, by the fact that your God lives, he's not as great as our God as you're going to see in this battle, but he's a great God. But the fact that he lives, if that's a sure thing, then I know it is certain that you've been upright. Now, what does he know about David? Has David been upright? Not in his vocabulary. But people sometimes will swear on something they know is the case when it is 180 degrees the other direction. He is upright. If only he knew the truth, he would have killed David himself. But he didn't know the truth. So he's outvoted. It must be embarrassing to send your bodyguard home. But that's what he's doing. And in verse 7, therefore, return now and go in peace that you may not displease the lords of the Philistines. So at least the lords let David live. Now, I don't know what David will have to protest about here. He's basically a man without the country, without a country. He can't go to Israel yet, and the Philistines don't want him. But I don't want you to displease the lords of the Philistines. You know, at one time, that was David's job, to displease as many Philistines as he could. And he was a pretty good doer of that deed. So in verse 8, David said to Achish, but what have I done? And to this day, what have you found in your servant as long as I've been with you, that I may not go and fight against the enemies of my Lord the King? That's a feeble protest. He doesn't throw his helmet. He doesn't kick dust. He doesn't wallow in the mud. He just says, what have I done? And what have you found in me that I can't go help you fight? I think there's a feeble protest because there's inward relief while there's an outward show of something else still deceiving this man. He says, my Lord the King. Who is he speaking of when he says, my Lord the King? Is it Saul or is it Achish? It's a little ambiguous that I may not go and fight against the enemies of my Lord the King. Obviously, Achish thinks he's referring to him. You're my Lord the King, and I'll fight against your enemies. Who is his real Lord and King, according to his own statement? Who's the anointed he won't lift up a sword against? King Saul. So it could be he's speaking with a double tongue here. I don't know. But in verse 9, Achish answered and said to David, I know that you are as good in my sight as an angel of God. You notice a lot of times people say, I know, when they don't know anything. It's the exact opposite of what they're saying. You're as good as an angel of God. If he knew the truth, he wouldn't be saying that either. He'd be saying you're on the level of a demon in hell. Nevertheless, the princes of the Philistines have said, he shall not go up with us to the battle. In other words, it's out of my hands. Now, it's really sad when worldly people have a higher sense of where God's people ought to be than they do. The Philistines know more where David ought to be than David does at this point. And it's sad when worldly people praise us for our fellowship and our help in times past. That's not a good thing either. And David hears both of those. Now in verse 10, now therefore rise early in the morning with your master's servants who have come with you. And as soon as you're up early in the morning and have light, depart. Your master's servants. Go back to the right, 1 Chronicles 12 for just a minute. 1 Chronicles 12, a number of people from Manasseh, had fallen to David and joined up with him during this time. And it may be these are the ones they're speaking of here. This is 1 Chronicles 12, starting at verse 19. Some from Manasseh defected to David when he was going with the Philistines to battle against Saul. See, that sets the time for our chapter. But they did not help him, for the lords of the Philistines sent him away by agreement, saying, he may defect to his master Saul and endanger our heads. When he went to Ziklag, those of Manasseh who defected to him, and then it gives their names, captains of thousands who were from Manasseh, and they helped David against the bands of raiders, for they were all mighty men of valor, and they were captains in the army. And it talks about the great army he had, like the army of God. So that's just a historical note that gives a little more light on what we're seeing here. Then he says, as soon as you're up early in the morning, and have light, depart. This is David's wake-up call. When you wake up in the morning, let this be a wake-up call. This is your escape. Make good use of it. So in verse 11, David and his men rose early to depart in the morning to return to the land of the Philistines, and the Philistines went up to Jezreel. He gets there just in time to see what's happened from the Amalekites to be able to chase them and get the spoils back, including their family, without the loss of a single life. So David, at this point, separates from the Philistines forever as any kind of a subordinate to them. The next thing you'll see is in chapter 3 of 2 Samuel, I believe is correct, he'll start having his first battles with the Philistines, and they'll say, oh boy, what have we done? So it'll be quite different in chapter 3 and 5 and 8 and 19 in several places there. He practically wipes them off the face of the earth. Any comments over 1 Samuel 29? Dave. Yes, it is.
What is with David, but when you read later in the Kings, you see, you know, maybe not all of those men and kings were with him at this time. Some of the men that were with him during his time were capable of killing up to 800 men.
Yes.
When you think about having someone that can turn against you that has that capability, you don't want them around.
You don't want them at your back. Yeah, you want them in front of you. Yeah, and it's scared enough. You'd be scared enough to have him in front of you, but certainly not behind you. That's a very good point. His mighty men, 30 are specifically named, and some higher in rank among them. Then Steve?
I was just going to say something similar. It's interesting, you know, we keep saying about David, but actually he had 600 men with him, so that didn't seem to break ranks at all. And you can kind of understand the Philistines soldiers probably feeling a little bit nervous about this. They send him back. Yeah. Interesting enough, you know, make peace with him. He had all the trust in the world.
What would we say today if we see a mall and they say, oh, don't worry about it, there's only 600 men from ISIS in it? What can 600 people do? What? Don't even want to think about such a thing. And so it's obvious, yeah, they have power and they could do a lot. Okay, any other comments?
You know, too, it seems, plus the priest was with him too.
So yes.
I wonder if maybe the king had noticed a little bit that all this was kind of coming into play when he made reference as far as the Lord God of heaven, as far as, well, maybe there might be something to David as God after all.
That is an interesting question, our point. I don't know myself, but it's an interesting point. He's learned somewhere to speak this way. Any others? Okay, 1 Samuel 30. David's family battle, his battle for his family, you might say. It happened when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day that the Amalekites had invaded the south and Ziklag, attacked Ziklag and burned it with fire. The amazing part of all this, and you can't see as much up here without a bigger map that we'll see in a moment. But David and his men are coming from Aphek. They're coming up here in this area. Saul and his men are going to camp at Mount Gilboa. There's where the battle line in this valley, this Jezreel Valley, the same place that we said that Sisera with his 900 chariots of iron were. And the Israelites are going to get their socks beat off. It is a slaughter. And they start running. And they run all the way back to their camp at Mount Gilboa with these people in their chariots and other means chasing after them. It was a nightmarish situation. They knew they'd lost. They were just trying to save their lives. And that didn't even work. And while they're on Mount Gilboa, it mentions the three sons of Saul who were with him, as well as Saul, who are up there. And you can just imagine so many arrows are being flung into the air up here on this place where it was the Israelite camp. How many people would have been killed with each volley? It just can't be really comprehended by me how that would have been and the terrifying nature of this. So it's going to be a terrible, terrible situation. When it says they came to Ziklag on the third day, that would imply a distance of about 50 to 60, give or take a few miles, that they come. Apparently, many of them on foot. Not everybody rode on camels or horses or donkeys to go. And it says they did this on the third day. So 3 days travel. But notice, this is 3 days travel, not in an air-conditioned car. Now, 3 days travel in a car is tough, isn't it? 3 days travel in a car is tough. Very tough. But you imagine walking that distance. And they get back just in time to be able to do something with this place that's been attacked. This long journey, this 3 day journey, they get back and they're ready to see their family again. They're tired. They're ready to rest. And they're probably hungry. They're ready for food. So family, satisfy hunger, satisfy the need for rest. And what do they see? Maybe even from a distance, the smoke coming up. Ziklag has been sacked. They've burned it to the ground. And they've taken every single person away, along with all the spoils, everything. That trip up north left the south unguarded. And so without any guard there, the Amalekites came in. They didn't kill their victims. You might have thought they would. Now, here's a commentary. In chapter 27, notice in verse 8, it tells us what David did. He spent this year and 4 months in the Philistine country. And in verse 8, David and his men went up and raided the Geshurites, the Girzites, and the Amalekites, for those nations were the inhabitants of the land from of old, as you go to Shur, even as far as the land of Egypt. Verse 9, when David attacked the land, he left neither man nor woman alive, but took away the sheep, the oxen, the donkeys, the camels, the apparel, and returned and came to Achish. And verse 11 goes on to explain, he would save neither man nor woman alive to bring news to Gath, saying, lest they inform on us. So, if you want to look at the morals of the situation, anybody would say David's morals were not up to that of the Amalekites on this occasion, which is really rather strange. David will be later called in 1 Chronicles 28, verse 3, a man of blood. And God will say, this man is not going to build my temple because he's been a man of blood. I have a feeling that means more than just killing Philistines that God wanted him to kill or helped him kill Goliath. but killing these others, who these women and children, others. Now, the Amalekites, these are the people that we've studied before. What do you know about the Amalekites? Saul was supposed to destroy them and did not do so. That's 1 Samuel. What chapter? Help me with this. What? 15. Saul's failure becomes the problem of the next generation. If we have a problem and we don't handle it, we pass it down for others to have to handle it, in which case it grows and gets worse. Furthermore, this is another evidence of the just wars of Israel. David aside, these are people who are ruthless, who in Exodus 17, remember what they did when the children of Israel are leaving the land of Egypt? What the Amalekites did? They attacked the rear. You know the word dry gulch? They dry gulched them. They shot them in the back, the stragglers, the old, the young, and so on. Deuteronomy 25, God says, therefore, because they've done this, you'll have enmity with these Amalekites the rest of your lives. And it came 400 years that would pass. And Saul comes and he's supposed to exterminate them. And you'll see them all through 1 and 2 Samuel. They haven't been exterminated at all. So the next generation has to deal with what Saul didn't. The Amalekites, I've wondered, may actually be retaliating against David for his raids against them. Interesting question, but I don't know how to answer it. In verse 2, they had taken captive the women and those who were there from small to great. They did not kill anyone, but carried them away and went their way. They didn't kill them, but you know what they usually did? They would sell them as slaves. And we know from Amos 1, if we have time we'll go there, but I doubt the clock's going to cooperate. Their reason for sparing women and children is not mercy. They had no mercy. We learned that in Exodus 17. Their reason for sparing them is to sell them into slavery, which in many cases is far worse than death. And so you have a number of occasions like that. There was a wide open slave market in that ancient world. And many of the nations listed there in Amos 1 and 2 are guilty of having sold slaves and not having any respect for the lives of men, women, and children. Now, Amalek knew that Israel and Philistia were at war. Did they say, well, since they're preoccupied with war, this is the time for us to strike. Let's strike while the iron's hot. So we'll go in while they're not expecting it, and we'll be able to do a lot. Tragedies often come in clusters. David's escape from a no-win situation now is followed by the worst news of his life, the capture of all of his family and his goods, and then his men want to blame him for letting it happen. The buck stops with David. So verse 3, David and his men came to the city, and there it was, burned with fire, and their wives, their sons, and their daughters. Their wives, their sons, and their daughters have been taken captive. What a horrible sight. You see that from a distance, the smoke rising. Where are the wives and the children? Do you look around in the gullies and the wadis and see if maybe they've thrown bodies down there, and what are you going to find if you look? You know, this is the stuff of which nightmares are made. David suffered in the same way as anybody else. He is going to weep as loudly as anyone else. Being the Lord's anointed, which David was, didn't insulate him from the tragedies of life. He could still suffer. And even after he becomes king, he's going to suffer mightily. He's going to learn that lesson very severely. In verse 4, then David and his men who were with him lifted up their voices and wept until they had no more power to weep. They've lost everything. Now, the Western society we live in, generally speaking, frowns upon grown men crying or showing any kind of emotion. Here, you see in this Near Eastern society, that was a very common thing. Here they say, well, control yourself, be a man, keep a stiff upper lip, get control of yourself. There, they just let it out. They cried loudly and they cried longly. And so these brave soldiers cried till no more tears were come. They certainly weren't Stoics. Now, if the Philistines hadn't sent David home, it would have been much worse. They'd have lost everything permanently. And so one lesson you learn here is not just because something is bad doesn't mean it couldn't be worse. It could have been even worse had not been for the Philistine lords of all people. Verse 5 mentions David's two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess and Abigail the widow of Nabal the Carmelite, had been taken captive. Amalekites show no partiality. You can see even today ISIS doing things that is in a level of violence we've just never seen before. Who else have you ever known to take a bomb and strap it onto a baby and put him on a plane and blow up that bomb in order to kill people you don't like? Who would do that to their own child? Or a five-year-old, knowing this five-year-old is going to walk in the midst of these people, have that bomb detonated and kill people. We've never seen that kind of that level of hate in all the time our country has been in existence. And they will take little children, they'll take women and crucify them on crosses and have done by the thousands, just like they would the men who are their opponents. Because they say, well, that's what you believe in, this is what we'll do for you. In verse 6, David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him, because the soul of all the people was grieved, every man for his sons and his daughters, but David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. Have you seen it over and over and over and over again? Some people can agree on a certain course of action, but if it doesn't turn out just as it is supposed to turn out, the one who is the leader in all this will be the scapegoat. They have to blame somebody. There's something in human nature that wants to blame someone, and it's not going to be me, and it's going to be you. And they're so angry and so distraught and so confused by their own ignorance and anger that they're going to have to lash out and take it out on somebody, and the scapegoat's going to be David in this case. So they're talking about stoning David. Are you serious? Do you really mean it? Apparently they didn't have the scruples he had about attacking the Lord's anointed. So the answer to some of this is, when you feel like lashing out against somebody else, look in the mirror first and see what you had to do with bringing this about. The expression in verse 6 is, the souls of all the people was grieved. That means be bitter, suffer anguish. Tim, did you have your hand up? Yeah.
And now those who he's trusted before are kicking him while he's down. They turn against him. That's really disturbing. When your own friends, people you trust, turn against him, that's the situation he's in.
You're exactly right, and that's well summarized. The only one who hasn't turned against him is who?
God.
He turns to God because God hasn't turned against him. That's a great lesson for us too. You'll notice, we won't be able to go through this, but read Psalm 3, read Psalm 6, and you'll see attitudes David had when he thought, Lord, I've cried enough to make my bed float away on tears, but I know you're there and you love me and will care for me. He never gives up on God, and God never gives up on him. He didn't ignore God. He didn't run from God. He didn't blame God. He didn't lose confidence in God. He certainly didn't say we need to abandon God. But what he does is turn to God in the time of his great need. This is typical David. This is what you see over and over in those Psalms. And then verse 7, this will be the last verse we'll get to cover, I suppose. David said to Abiathar the priest, Ahimelech's son, please bring the ephod here to me. And Abiathar brought the ephod to David. David seeks specific guidance by this high priest. I need you to tell me specifically what I need to do. Is there any way to recover these people? And if so, what must I do? So when Saul faces tragedy, where does he go? To a witch. When David faces tragedy, where does he go? To the Lord, always. So his difficulties in the past, and he's had plenty of them, have all driven him to the Lord, and this is no exception. Any comments? Okay, we'll plan to take, starting with verse 8, this part next week. Thank you very highly.